Before we get into today's show, I have some urgent news to share with you. Premier Insight's financial year ends on June 30th, and it's vital we close a final funding gap of $65,000 by that date. The great news is a generous friend of the ministry has offered to match the first $10,000 given to help jumpstart giving towards this goal. But we must fully meet the $10,000 for it to be released. That's why I wanted to take a moment before we get into today's podcast to ask for your help. If you would, please take a moment today to give your best gift at premierinsight.org/unbelievableshow. That's premierinsight.org/unbelievableshow. Thank you for understanding how important your gift is today and for giving generously. And now it's time for today's podcast. Before we get into today's show, I have some urgent news to share with you. Premier Insight's financial year ends on June 30th, and it's vital we close a final funding gap of $65,000 by that date. The great news is a generous friend of the ministry has offered to match the first $10,000 given to help jumpstart giving towards this goal. But we must fully meet the $10,000 for it to be released. That's why I wanted to take a moment before we get into today's podcast to ask for your help. If you would, please take a moment today to give your best gift at premierinsight.org/unbelievableshow. That's premierinsight.org/unbelievableshow. Thank you for understanding how important your gift is today and for giving generously. And now it's time for today's podcast.
Good afternoon. Welcome along. I'm Justin Brierley with you for the next hour and a half or so here at Premier. And I'm delighted to have your company for Unbelievable. It's the show where Christians and non-Christians get together to talk about all kinds of things. My thanks to Megan for Premier's I Choose. And you can keep listening this afternoon and hear Dave and B with Hip Rock UK. And then Loretta Fenton presents from 6 o'clock. That's all to come this Saturday afternoon. Right now, it's time to do what we do at this time every week. You're unbelievable. As Christians and non-Christians get together to talk, today we're going to be hearing from Dr. Tom Woodward of the C.S. Lewis Society. He's the author of Doubts About Darwin and Darwin Strikes Back, and as you might be able to tell from those titles, he's an intelligent design theorist. He believes that evolution does not hold the key to understanding how the world came into being, and human beings certainly did not evolve in the way that is suggested. He says things are simply too complicated for that to be the case. Well, in favour of, if you like, the atheistic view of evolution, Pete Harty is on the programme today from the National Secular Society. Other contributors also joining us for this. Darwin versus Design. That's the subject of our programme here on Unbelievable. And it's just such a big topic, isn't it? It just doesn't go away. We've just been having Richard Dawkins on Channel 4 for the last few weeks telling us that, essentially Darwinism has taken away any kind of point in believing in God. So it's an appropriate sort of debate to be airing today. Do hope you enjoy it. We're going to be meeting those guests shortly. But first of all, some responses to the last couple of weeks of programming. In fact, I'm going to go back 2 weeks and just play some response, because we had a lot of response to the program where Jonathan Castro came on and spoke to church pastor Nigel Desborough. Now, you may remember Jonathan was on the program, at least, a chap who really had been to a lot of churches in his life, but never felt like he'd met God, never felt like he'd experienced God, and had even gone to the length of setting up an anti-church website. A lot of you wanted to get in contact about that. I'll read some of your email responses in a moment. But first of all, we'll hear some phone responses. Before we get to those, let me just say one exciting piece of information. If you're a listener to Premier, then this week you will have heard about the fact that we've launched officially our Premier community. This is an online website, and you can get to it via my webpage. If you're an unbelievable listener, that's probably the easiest way to do it. Go to premier.org.uk/unbelievable and click on the link on that page to the Premier community. And lots of people joining up now to interact with other Premier listeners, to interact with the presenters. I've got a page on there. Feel free to visit it. Send me a line. tell me who you are, whether you listen to the show, that sort of thing. And lots of interesting discussions going on. There's blogs, there's pictures, there's video, audio, and lots of discussions, a lot of them based actually around some of the themes coming out of this programme. So go again to the Unbelievable webpage and log on to the Premier community there. That's premier.org.uk/unbelievable. It's a great way to get your feelings heard on the programmes that we're airing here. Okay, so some responses to our inquirer of a couple of weeks ago, Jonathan Castro. Here's some of them now.
Hi, Justin. Chris Cox. God knows the beginning from the end, so he would know whether you became a Christian or not in your lifetime. That's how I believe we are predestined, that he knows whether we gave our life to Jesus or not when we was alive. And if I was in that gentleman's position, and I knew what I knew about God, I think I would do what Jacob did. I'd say, I will not let you go till you bless me. And I would also be in God's face so much until he revealed himself to me. And I think this gentleman is believing a lie. And I think he should just get hold of God and not let him go.
Hello, this is Gemma Hobbs from UK. Jonathan, I understand where you're at, having sort of knowledge of God and not a reality. God's revealed himself through his spirit, and what you may come from of religion, because you come in contact with religion, but not by his spirit. And his love draws you to him, because that draws us to repentance. Now, I understand exactly where you're coming from, because there are many, many people that know of God but not know him personally. Receive his love. Receive the gift of salvation. Because if you're trying too hard to please God, you won't get anywhere. You'll just get burned out and exhausted. But the minute you accept that you are loved by the beloved, you are his beloved, that your sins are washed away, that you believe that Jesus has cleansed you, and you receive his love and salvation, you will feel a reality in your life. You might have had some bad experiences, but know that God loves you and receive that love.
Well, thank you to Chris and Gemma for those messages. Okay, here's some emails that came in. Andrew says, Dear Justin, one couldn't help feeling sympathy with Mr. Castro, but I couldn't help feeling that what he was describing was something like an old church view, that all one needed to do was to follow certain rules to guarantee salvation, or that they would lead to an infusion of spirit. In the latter case, something like a reward came to mind, much in the way that we're led to believe that effort is rewarded in the secular domain. It's no surprise he gets little comfort from religion, since spirituality is much greater in involvement than simple rule following. Going to church is not the main function of religion, but it does provide a focal point. Given the multiplicity of types of Christian churches, does this not indicate the variety of different ways that are tailored to suit us in our different groupings? Mr. Castro has not yet found one to suit him, but he should be more careful before passing judgment on others. I myself am very critical of the church my parents raised me in, but even though I now attend a different one, I'm grateful to them for giving me some grounding, even though there is a gap of some 30 years between leaving and finding my faith again. Andrew, thank you very much. Let's go to another email here. This is from Grace Freeman. Grace, you say, I would like to provide a contrasting answer to the problem of not finding God in church. While the commonly held Christian view is that Christians should, like coals in a fire, meet together to stay hot, burning coals rather than leaving the church and going cold, we have to look at the issue of why Christians are going to church. Firstly, if it's to get a high and find God through happy feelings, they're not at the right place. Church is about community, people like you and me trying to find their way in life and often getting it wrong. If we were honest, we don't always get things right, so we have to be able to forgive the actions of some Christians in churches. When we can't, it may be a core reason for people leaving church. Secondly, we can become church junkies, as my vicar coined the phrase last Sunday. If Christians are doing so much in church that they no longer look at why they're involved, they're quickly going to find their heart going cold to God and their relationship going stale as a consequence. I support the view that our churches can sometimes promote the prosperity gospel, as they sometimes promise the wrong things. things. Churches should focus on preaching God's word, encouraging a real relationship with God, which has its highs and lows, and less on the experiences we have. Yes, we can get healing in church and miracles occur, and I myself have experienced that, but it's not the reason I go. I go for community, to meet with like-minded people, to find and to give support, to meet with Christ, including in the people around me. Thank you, Grace. That's a lovely email. And just got time for one more. Yes, I think we have. This was actually one that came in on a postcard, and I'm going to send this on to Jonathan, as well as forwarding the emails that I've received. This is from Kate. She says, firstly, regarding the discussion, you're not alone in having an uneasy relationship with church, Jonathan. There's a lot of us. Welcome to the club. May I recommend a life-changing book, if you haven't already read it, by Canadian pastor Brooksy Cavey, called The End of Religion. Whittled down to its bare essentials, his message is that if we feel frustrated with organized religion, we're in very good company, as Jesus Christ felt the same way. We must never mistake the form for the substance, the vessel for what it contains. The church service isn't meant to replace our relationship with God or deliver a product, but assist us in finding or strengthening that relationship. And you go on to give some great advice on how Jonathan might maybe find other forms of worship that suit him better. Thank you for those messages. Just time for a couple more phone messages, and then we're finished in regard to the responses to that program with Jonathan Castro. If you want to listen back to it, you're intrigued, you haven't actually heard it, it's the program of 2 weeks ago. It's available on the Unbelievable webpage to listen back, premier.org.uk/unbelievable. And while you're there, as I say, do check out the Premier community. So here's a couple of responses that focus more in on whether the issue of forgiveness is a factor in whether Jonathan's been finding it hard to, as it were, find God.
I was intrigued to hear the comment of a person who said that God hasn't revealed himself to him. I was surprised about that because, I mean, you would know the Bible more than I do, but there's a certain part in the Bible that talks about, which says about people who have done wrong things. If they do not repent, he would hear them and would not answer them. So I wonder if one can go back to that and put this to the person. You know, I mean, I don't mean to offend anybody, but, I mean, it could be something he may have done in his past and he hasn't bothered to repent for it, and therefore God is not revealing himself to him. Thank you. Bye-bye.
My name is Celia. When I myself first became a Christian, I didn't know how. And I used to pray night after night, day after day, and nothing used to happen. Until I didn't know then it was the Holy Spirit, but I do know now, that he said to write it down. So I wrote him 8 pages of all the sins I could remember I've done against people and against everybody, and I asked him to forgive me. And that's how I came to Christ. That's how I was led to Christ by the Holy Spirit himself. I wrote a letter to God, and I said to him, I expect your answer. And then after saying that, I just felt like I was light. The heavy sins, the weight had gone. That's why it was so light. So I don't know if that Richard, I don't know his name. I can't remember his name, if he wants to try that. But I don't think he should give up. I think he should just come as he is. Keep praying those prayers until you receive Christ. You know, because he said to search for him and we will find him. Seek after him and you will. So thank you. God bless you. Bye-bye.
Well, thank you for all those responses. Fascinating as usual. And please do take note of the number and email address for the programme today. We'd love to get some responses on this intelligent design issue, which we're going to be looking at today. Darwin versus design. We'll be meeting our guests very shortly. Time now, though, for John Twistleton. He's tackling another difficult question that often faces Christians.
Frequently Asked Questions with John Twistleton.
I know someone who was prayed for and they didn't get better. How can God be selective in the prayers he answers? You've heard it, maybe even thought it yourself. When someone's close to you, they show their closeness by kind actions. If God's close, how is it he can appear so inattentive to our desires? Whilst I was thinking about how best to answer this question, my son asked me to give him something, and I chose to say no. I felt really bad, or rather my son made me feel rather bad, but I stuck to my guns. I felt he needed to take responsibility for this task himself and that I would spoil him if I gave him what he wanted. Isn't that how God must feel towards some of the things people ask him? Knowing my own pain at saying no to the son I love, how much more pain God must feel when people complain he's selective in the prayers he answers. Prayer's a loving relationship, not a slot machine. Though prayer's based on the conviction the universe has a heart, that doesn't mean an indulgent heart. What Christians have seen of God in Jesus shows us pure unselfishness. What if God wants most of all that we should be as unselfish as he is? How would he go about helping us deny ourselves? How would the way he answers our prayers fit into that ultimate scheme of things? At first, it can seem harsh not to get what you want from someone. But if that someone actually knows better than you do what your real need is, that will give a different slant on things. It's Christian faith that there is a God, and that he wants the very best for us. St. John says in the third chapter of his first letter that what we do know is this: when he is revealed, we will be like him, for we will see him as he is. And all who have this hope in him purify themselves just as he is pure. I know someone who has prayed for and they didn't get better. That person may be seeing God with the saints in heaven for all we know. Sick people don't always get better. Many of them die. We all die in the end. Christianity isn't about getting a better life in this world, but about getting the best of all lives in the world to come. To believe in God is to acknowledge a friend out of this world in every sense who's got out of this world benefits for us. God lives out of time, so most fruits of our prayer relationship with him are invisible, stored up in heaven, as St. Peter puts it. God's plan for us has been described as a tapestry he's weaving, beautiful from his side, but with a lot of loose ends hanging down on our side. To have faith is to believe God's in ultimate control of the world and that Jesus is Lord. It's not to believe that every circumstance in life is made for your comfort. St. Paul was martyred for Christ. He wrote in chapter 8 of his letter to the Romans that neither hardship or distress or persecution or famine or nakedness or peril or sword will be able to separate us from the love of Christ, and that all things work together for those who love God. When people express their disappointment that a prayer's not being answered, it's a natural reaction. Christianity, though, is a supernatural calling to share the divine nature. If the God and Father of Jesus lives in you, the Bible makes it clear you'll grow closer and closer to him if you persevere in faith. Accepting unanswered prayer is a sign of perseverant faith. I know someone who has prayed for and they didn't get better. How can God be selective in the prayers he answers? There's no simple answer to this question. It will depend on circumstances as seen by God in the full perspective he alone enjoys. In prayer, people can be arrogant. They need to truly bow down to God even when he feels absent. God is love beyond our understanding. However things seem to appear, in the end, God knows best, because God is God. It's as simple and challenging as that.
If you have any difficult questions about the Christian faith, or have your own answer for the frequently asked question we looked at today, please visit www.premier.org.uk/FAQ to contribute to the programme.
John Twistleton back again at the same time next week. And if you want to respond to anything you hear in his regular section in this programme, do, as I say, log on to the Premier community. Interesting conversations going on there about some of the issues he's been raising. The Premier community can be accessed via the Unbelievable webpage. That's premier.org.uk/unbelievable. And why not check out what Nick Peters is saying about Father John Twistleton's frequently asked questions as well in his Deeper Waters blog. That's at deeperwaters.wordpress.com. Thanks, Nick, for letting me know about that. Nick, a recent new listener to Unbelievable. Right, it's time to get on with the show in hand.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
And you're very welcome to be joining us this Saturday afternoon, as we have a very interesting debate for you. We always have interesting debates, of course, here on Unbelievable, but I've really been looking forward to this one. You may remember, a while back, covered the subject of intelligent design and evolution. And, well, we were very pleased to receive an award, actually, for that programme recently, the New York Radio Awards, awarded that a gold medal. But I suppose one of the reasons why that might have been acknowledged in America specifically is because because it is such a hot potato over there. This idea that intelligent design, the theory that life is simply too complex to have developed by the traditional Darwinian theory of evolution, and in many areas exhibits characteristics of having been designed. That's essentially what intelligent design theorists would have us believe. And of course, the traditional view of evolution is that life developed through a process of mutation and natural selection, and over millions of years that's given rise to the variety we see in the world around us. Well, two special guests joining me for today's programme, both pretty expert in their field, I think that's fair to say. Firstly, Dr. Tom Woodward, he's founder and director of the C.S. Lewis Society and professor at Trinity College, Florida. He's been involved in the ID debate for some time, and his award-winning book, Doubts About Darwin, provides a historical and philosophical overview of the movement. And he's just brought out a new one, Darwin Fights Back. That essentially is the sequel. Our other guest today, Darwin Strikes Back, I should say. Just had the book waved at me by Tom. Pete Harty is a member of the National Secular Society, and along with the majority of the scientific world, he believes in the theory of evolution as the best explanation for life. A warm welcome to both of you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for being here. Perhaps start with you first of all, Tom, as we get the introductions done. How long have you been involved in this field, this debate?
Well, if you go back to my undergraduate years when I was a student at Princeton University and I was struggling with the information on origins, I'd say from like 1969. I guess that's a 36-year process. But more recently, in the last 20 years, since 1986, I've been intensely researching this field, and I've been privileged to know a number of key leaders in the area of Darwinian evolution in the U.S. especially. But I've also been thrilled to get to know personally virtually every major leader of the intelligent design movement. And I've actually been in some of their meetings before I had my doctorate. I was the fly on the wall, taking notes, if you will.
And essentially, you've chronicled the movement in the book Doubts About Darwin and its sequel, Darwin Strikes Back. I got that right.
You got it right.
But to take us a little bit further back, I mean, Christian faith for you, has that always been something?
It was a development later in life. I mean, when I say later, I was not as a youth really in any way persuaded, committed, whatever. I was raised in a nominal, denominationally Protestant, but a nominal Christian home, and went through all the motions, but never believed in, virtually never believed in any of it. I became an agnostic by the time I entered my first year at Princeton University, and heard about a group of students there who actually bought into the idea of creation, not so much just on biblical basis, but scientifically. They said there are very strong scientific reasons for. And I thought that was absurd, idiotic, crazy. I felt like throwing a fork at one of these students one night at dinner at the dining hall, and he dodged my fork, so to speak, metaphorically speaking. And but I was just determined to re-educate these idiotic ignoramuses. And I wound up hearing, something about the Christian faith for the first time, and clarity and intelligence. But then later on, after I became a follower of Christ, I was still strongly committed Darwinist, that God used Darwinian evolution. And then it was because I encountered various scientific critiques after that you might say step by step, I realized that, the evidence was not all it was cracked up to be. At least that was my conclusion.
I mean, one of your other hats is that you are the founder and director of the C.S. Lewis Society.
Yes, and I'm an Anglophile and a Lewisphile, okay? I love C.S. Lewis. I've tried to read everything I can, but we model after him, to being an apostle to the intellectual.
I mean, C.S. Lewis, in many ways, of course, also made apologetics accessible for ordinary people as well. I mean, is that part of what your intention is?
Yeah, we want people to be excited about the realm of thought, just the realm of rational thought. We believe that when you become a Christian, you do not, as it were, put your brains on the shelf. If anything, you put your brains in high gear. And we believe that the Christian faith, we don't think that we can prove it with any kind of, let's say, mathematical proof. That's never been a possibility for any of the theistic claims or non-theistic claims. We believe that it's more subtle. But we believe that you can really, as it were, become a very robustly thinking person as a Christian. So you put your brains in high gear again.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you very much for joining us. And thanks for your presence here in the UK.
It's been a delight.
In what I'm sure is a busy schedule.
It is.
Our other guest today, Pete Harty. Pete is an atheist, but let's just make clear from the outset that the debate we're having today is not about atheism versus Christianity, as often is the case in other programs that we do. It is about a debate going on within the scientific community that has Christians and non-Christian on both sides, and that's something that's important to say, I think, from the outset. But Pete, thank you for being here. You, of course, were a guest on a very similar discussion we had back in February, the program I've alluded to already. You haven't been won over to intelligent design in the 7 or 8 months since.
Oddly enough, no. As you probably know, when I was young, I was a Catholic and actually spent several years as a teenager at a junior seminary training to be a priest. And at no time throughout my time as a Catholic did it ever occur to me that there was any conflict between science and religion. Now, I'm sure Dr. Woodward wouldn't characterize intelligent design as being such a conflict, but some people do perceive it as that. And if there's one thing I want to try and get across to people today, there is absolutely nothing in science, and there is nothing in particular in the theory of evolution, which contradicts a Christian faith or a belief in God. They are entirely separate issues. And anyone who tries to present Christians with a choice between evolution or God is giving them a false choice. You can have both.
Okay, so and obviously there are many Christians.
Absolutely.
We're going to be hearing actually later in the program some of the thoughts from one person who got in touch with me in advance of the program, Michael Roberts. He's an evangelical vicar in Lancashire who has very much been involved in this debate, and I'll be putting some of his questions and thoughts to our guests here in the studio. We're also going to be joined throughout the program by a couple of other phone guests as well on both sides of the debate. They are Chris Hyland, a PhD biology student at Leeds University, and Peter S. Williams of the Damaris Trust, who will be speaking on the side of intelligent design. He, again, you may ring a bell. He was our other protagonist on that programme back in February. Well, we're going to be opening up some interesting areas today. Fundamentally, I think one of the big questions that still remains is, does intelligent design actually count as science? This is something we tackled before, but it comes up again and again. Now, Pete, why for you does intelligent design simply not come under the banner of a science?
If I can, I'd like to argue this by analogy. A few weeks ago, I had a cold. Now, there's a scientific explanation for that. I could have gone to the hospital, got a blood test, they would have found some antibodies and said, yeah, there was a certain virus that caused your cold. Of course, that doesn't prove that a virus caused my cold. But if you test lots of people that have colds and they all have this virus, and lots of people that don't have colds and they don't have this virus, then you're on pretty solid ground. The evidence, the circumstantial evidence, begins to build up and build up to the point where you become pretty convinced that a virus causes a cold. But there's another explanation for my cold 2 weeks ago. Maybe someone in my street doesn't like me and they put a curse on me. Mm-hmm. Now, I can't disprove that. Short of taking all the little old ladies in the street, tying them to chairs and dunking them in the River Thames, shouting, confess, confess, and I don't actually want to do that, but I can't really get a definitive answer to whether someone cursed me or not. Mm-hmm. But notice that those two explanations are actually not contradictory. It's perfectly possible for some little old lady not to like me and put a curse on me, and as a result, I create a virus. The virus is more a how-type question, whereas the other one is a why-type question. Now, addressing those type of questions, why something happens, as opposed to how it happens, isn't really, generally speaking, the province of science, because you can't generally resolve a why-type question absolutely 100%. You can't test it. There's no way you can go out and do experiments or look for evidence. You can only have arguments. Whereas in the scientific argument about the virus causing the cold, I can disprove it if I find the people with a cold that don't have a virus, or I can get more and more evidence that substantiates the hypothesis. So that would be a scientific case. Now, I think intelligent design falls into the realm of a non-scientific explanation. It infers design, but more than that, it infers intelligent design. In other words, it infers God. That's what we're essentially talking about. Now, science can't address that question. You can't put God in a test tube and do experiments on him and find out what his intentions were. That's why I believe it's not a scientific theory. It doesn't mean it's wrong. It just means it's not science.
Okay. Well, we're going to allow Tom to reply to that on the other half of our break. But you've heard certainly the critique there of intelligent design as a scientific study. We're going to be digging into intelligent design over the next hour or so. So we're looking forward to this. We'll see you on the other side of the break here on Unbelievable as we look at Darwin versus...
I just wanted to quickly remind you that Premier Insight has been offered a $10,000 matching grant that will double your gift today. And right now, that's an incredible blessing as we're needing $65,000 before the end of the financial year on June 30th. This show depends on the generosity of friends like you. So I'm asking you to give your very best gift right now to meet this $65,000 need, knowing your gift will be doubled. You can give now at premierinsight.org/unbelievableshow. That's premierinsight.org/unbelievableshow. Thank you. I just wanted to quickly remind you that Premier Insight has been offered a $10,000 matching grant that will double your gift today. And right now, that's an incredible blessing as we're needing $65,000 before the end of the financial year on June 30th. This show depends on the generosity of friends like you. So I'm asking you to give your very best gift right now to meet this $65,000 need, knowing your gift will be doubled. You can give now at premierinsight.org/unbelievableshow. That's premierinsight.org/unbelievableshow. Thank you.
Design.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
Welcome along this Saturday afternoon. Dr. Tom Woodward is founder and director of the C.S. Lewis Society. He's a professor at Trinity College in Florida. He has written an award-winning book, Doubts About Darwin. It provides a historical overview of the intelligent design movement. And his new book, the sequel to that, Darwin Strikes Back, is out at the moment. Well, he's our protagonist in today's programme, arguing that there is an intelligent designer behind the scenes in the world we see around us, that life is simply too complex to have developed by the traditional Darwinian theory of evolution. On the other side, Pete Harty, defending evolution. Pete's a member of the National Secular Society, and along with the majority of the scientific world, he believes that that the theory of evolution is enough to explain the beginnings of life and the way we see such vast variety in the world around us. Don't forget, if you want to respond to anything you hear on the programme today, you can do that via the email address unbelievable@premier.org.uk, or indeed, why not call us and leave a phone message on 08456 52 52 52 and select option 5. Well, just before we went to the break, gentlemen, we had Pete telling us that as far as he's concerned, intelligent design, because it introduces the concept of God as an explanation, falls into a quite different category to that of science, because God is not a quantity that we can test. You can't put God in a test tube and say, you know, this happens and that happens. You can't make predictions as far as God is concerned. But presumably you disagree that that discounts intelligent design, Tom, as a scientific theory.
I do. Let me just revisit the definition of intelligent design. I think it's been muddied a bit, because the two definitions that have been given thus far really are not accurate. There have been two definitions brought out. Intelligent design does not say that life is too complex. I think that was maybe just in the way you referred to it earlier, to have developed without an intelligent cause. We say that's close but not quite right. Let me just say, the living systems of the world and the universe have some features, not all, but there are some features which are much more compellingly and plausibly explain by reference to an intelligent cause than to natural causes in the universe, nature-driven causes, such as natural selection. So we're saying not every feature, we're saying some features. Mm-hmm. And so it's a minimalist theory. And that's exactly what the way the Discovery Institute defines it. Mm-hmm. What we're saying in a nutshell is that intelligent causes are detectable. They're empirically detectable through strict scientific methodology. And so for that reason alone, I think that intelligent design deserves a place at the table as an intelligent, as a scientific theory. An example of that, let me just tick off two or three points here. SETI, S-E-T-I, stands for Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence, which has even been sponsored at times by the NASA, you know, the Space Administration of the U.S., is predicated on the concept that you can detect intelligent causes. You can detect, without knowing who, precisely who or what is sending those signals from outer space, if you detect, as in the movie Contact, prime numbers sent across the space. Mm-hmm. And then within that embedded the plans, I think, in the movie for some kind of space probe. Mm-hmm. You can detect, apart from knowing who the product or the producer of those signals are, you can detect intelligence. So we believe that there are religious implications, but intelligent design as a theory does not depend on a single religious premise. Let me just mention, can I mention two more points quick? Mm. Good theories produce predictions. Intelligent design has produced a whole raft of predictions. One of them, voiced very clearly in our literature in the 1990s, was that junk DNA is not so junky. That the supposed useless DNA that we see out there actually has function. And they said, we need to work on this. Well, the crowing from the other side, Darwinists said, this is junk DNA, it's proof of evolution, this is leftover junk from earlier generations. Well, hello, in the last 2 or 3 years, lo and behold, there's a new paradigm shift. Junk DNA is not so junky. It's been found over the last several months and years to have multiple practical procedural usages inside the cell. And also, a theory should be testable. You should be able to test it. Now, one of the main claims of the other side is the ID has been cannot be tested. Mm. And then the next day, they turn around and say, we've tested it and found it wanting. Now, you can't have it both ways. Mm. Either you say it's not testable, or you test it and find it wrong. Well, they say that we've tested and found it wrong. In page 60 of my new book, I talk about this new April 7th, 2002 issue of Science. And this article supposedly disproves Behe. I think the article is an absurd article if you say it's a good article, but it's absurd to say it disproves Behe. I think it vindicates irreducible complexity, the work of Dr. Behe. So I think it has been found to be good science.
Okay. I'll allow Pete to respond to some of those ideas, but then I'd like us just to have a quick nail down what you're talking about when you say irreducible complexity.
Okay, sure.
Behe, these are terms which may be completely going over the head of many people who are maybe new to this whole debate. But what those three points then that Tom's made there, Pete, as far as he's concerned, if you can, you know, it's perfectly acceptable to, as it were, say if design is something we use in many other sciences. We look for a purpose, a cause. Why not in this case? And does the fact that it leads us to something which maybe scientists are uncomfortable with, is that a cause for throwing it out?
Well, no, it's a very good question. One of the interesting things about things like the search for extraterrestrial intelligence is that when you receive a signal which you think denotes some kind of intelligence, you're effectively making the assumption there that it's sourced from an intelligent being. It's the same when you do, say, forensics. You're trying to investigate a crime and you use evidence that's based on the assumption that someone is responsible for the crime. That's important. You're actually building in to that theory right from the start the assumption that some intelligence is behind what you're looking for. That's not the case with intelligent design. Intelligent design claims that through the evidence we can infer the existence of an intelligent designer. We're not assuming one a priori. We're saying that we can suggest that one exists because of the evidence. So it's quite different. The analogy isn't quite right. On the question of junk DNA, Dr. Woodward's absolutely correct. Some junk DNA has been discovered to have some functions after all. But there still remains cases of genes in the human genome which are quite definitely switched off. things like 63% of the genes that control smell are switched off in humans, switched off in certain other closely related primates, but not switched off in some other species. So we know that they can perform a function, but they don't. Now, that to me suggests quite the opposite of design. Why would someone design in something that isn't used? It's entirely consistent with the theory of evolution, where we had a common ancestor who did have greater powers of smell than we have. We don't need them now. We don't switch them on. We don't waste energy in producing proteins that we don't need.
Okay. Any response to that, briefly, Tom?
Well, yeah, I think I don't follow the analogy on the SETI that they just kind of assume intelligence and then send a response. No, I think that's – I would strongly, you know, say that the SETI program detects patterns of – mathematical patterns of bits of radio signals. And what intelligent design says is if you have extremely low probability – if something has like a 1 in 10 to the 150th power, which is like throwing, you know, 25 perfect poker hands in a row, and if you have a low probability and if you have what's called independent specification, if the pattern matches some ideal pattern or recognizable pattern apart from that process, like if I have this perfect poker hand, we know it matches a perfect pattern apart from just random, you know, arrangements of cards, then you know that intelligence, it isn't like just an assumption. No, it's a proper inference. But we believe that we can mathematically prove it using what we call the explanatory filter of Dr. Dembski. And so we believe that the inference is solid. It's based on mathematics and observation of the real world.
In simple terms, then, what did Dr. Dembski say? Because Dembski is one of the key players in this movement, isn't
he? Well, Dembski says, basically, intelligence isn't something that you kind of like put your hands on the crystal ball and says, oh, I kind of intuit, I kind of feel, you know, it's just like, oh, I just kind of has this kind of, you know, vague impression of intelligence. No, if you have low probability and if you have a high specification, like the faces of the Mount Rushmore, the four presidents out on Mount Rushmore, then it was designed. And you can infer that solidly. It's not just a vague guess.
We obviously don't have time to go into the mathematics.
Yes,
of
we
that.
Won't bother. It'd give people a headache.
Let's just briefly, as well, before we get to come back to Pete and indeed our phone guests for some comments on this, go to the other central plank of the intelligent design movement, which was forwarded by Michael Behe. This irreducible complexity. Mm-hmm. Briefly, what is that?
The idea of irreducible complexity says that you have inside a cell. A system, a machine, literally a machine made of miniature protein parts, tiny, tiny parts, a billionth of an inch long or a billionth of a meter long. And in this machine, if you take one of the parts away, it's, for example, the flagellum, it's an outboard motor on the back end of many bacteria. It has a rotary engine and a propeller and a drive shaft and all these things. If you take one of the parts away, the machine shuts down. It does not function. And if you have 40 parts to make the flagellum work, how could you ever evolve the machine in the first place? Because you don't get the function until all 40 parts are there. And so it's an argument from the direct observation of complex systems, which Dr. Behe argues could not plausibly have developed step by tiny evolutionary step until you get to the full machine.
Because let's just bring Pete back in here. Well, what about this? Irreducible complexity. Some things are so had to all be there in place from the beginning for them to work like that. They couldn't have
right.
developed step
I mean,
by
step. There was quite a lot in what Dr. Woodward said there. And I'll see if I can remember as much of it as I can. One of it is the idea that something is so incredibly improbable that it's not going to happen by chance. And he gave the example of a round of cards, and I think that's quite a good example. If you have a bridge hand or something like that, where you get the perfect set time after time after time, you probably think that it's been fiddled. You know, someone's been doing something to change the cards. The reason you think that is because out of all the possible combinations of cards, and I did a calculation once, if you did a round of cards a million times a second for every second since the start of the universe, you still wouldn't get close to using every combination of cards that was possible in a pack. It's so big. Now, when you're talking about those kind of numbers, when out of that, the number of ordered sets of cards out of the number of disordered sets is tiny. in comparison. So when you see a particular order coming out, you assume that something has been done to select those particular cards. I use the word select deliberately. Right? It can be done by intelligence, but there are other mechanisms of doing selection. Natural selection is one. Competition between fitter and less fit animals is another way of actually creating a design, a very effective design. So the same is true of Dembski's filter. What it shows is that something is highly improbable by chance alone. What it does not show is that intelligence is behind that selection mechanism. On the case of the flagellum, the bacterial flagellum, you quite rightly said if you take some of the parts away, it's not going to work. But of course, that's not what we're trying to achieve in evolution. In evolution, what you want to find is a plausible pathway that put them together, not how to take them apart. Now, just because we don't know what that plausible pathway is now doesn't mean we give up. Now, you say you research it doggedly, but biochemistry has only been around in its modern form for, what, about half a century? I mean, it's ridiculous to dismiss at this point complex problems in biology because we don't know the answer.
Let's go to a biologist right now. By the way, in case you've just tuned in, you're listening to a debate on intelligent design and evolution. Intelligent design being the theory that life, as we see it, is simply, well, I said too complex, but that's not quite the right way.
There are some features in the universe that manifest features of intelligence more than they do causation by natural processes.
Okay, and that's what we're looking at. Is it possible that science needs to wake up to a radical revision and to say Darwin simply doesn't explain, that there's simply too many holes, as it were, that Darwin fails to explain, that evolution fails to explain, and we need a new theory, we need intelligent design. Let's bring in at this point Chris Hyland. Chris is a PhD biology student at Leeds and one of the co-founders of justscience.org.uk, a website that's been established in response to the Truth in Science organisation, who have recently been featured in the news for trying to see intelligent design included on science curriculum in the UK. Good afternoon to you, Chris.
Good afternoon.
Thanks for being with us. You've been hearing the conversation going on here in the studio. What would you like to bring to the debate at this point?
My problem with the claim that intelligent design is a scientific theory, or the idea these systems are best explained by intelligence, my problem is saying intelligence isn't an explanation. It doesn't tell me how these systems came to be. However, with the theory of evolution, we do have a plausible explanation of how these systems came to be. So therefore, it's what we call parsimony in science, kind of this Occam's razor, that we don't need to posit hyperintelligence to explain these systems. In terms of the intelligent design arguments, my main problem with specified complexity, it involves us calculating a probability of some system, say the bacterial flagellum, forming through natural causes. We can't do that. That's impossible with our current state of knowledge to actually get a number on that. Dembski does it in one of his books. He uses what I call a straw man version of evolution. He discounts one pathway and then says that there are no other pathways, and he doesn't look at the other pathways. And it's the same with irreducibility. To say if you have a system that you remove one part and it ceases to function, that system couldn't have formed by the gradual addition of parts. But that's not the only way evolution works. There's several other mechanisms to get to these kind of systems. And both of those, irreducible complexity was predicted as a outcome of evolution nearly 100 years ago by Hermann Muller, a geneticist. He called it interlocking complexity. Specified complexity was predicted as an outcome of evolution in the 70s by Leslie Orgel. So none of these things are a surprise for biologists. This is what we expected, these kind of complex systems.
Do you feel like then the intelligent design movement is simply pointing out a problem, not giving any solution to the problem, and throwing its hands up in the air and saying it must be God?
Basically, I suppose. They're not providing an explanation. They're saying we think intelligent. These systems look like they're intelligently designed. Well, I think these systems look like they evolved based on study of them and conversations with, with people who work on them. There is no theory of intelligent design.
Okay. Tom?
Well, we've had two Darwinian responses. I'll try to respond to both of those. The ability of natural selection is something I'd like to bear down on, because let me just give some background here. In the 1980s, there was the beginning of what I call a rapid movement away from the power of natural selection. Pierre Grasset, I don't know if our two Darwinist friends on the broadcast have read the book Evolution of Living Organisms. Pierre Grasset, a leading French zoologist, whom Dobzhansky said his knowledge of the living world was encyclopedic. Grasset said the plausibility of natural selection having accomplished this grand tree of life is below credible. He called it absurd. And he mercilessly attacked and exposed the problems of those who were saying that, as it were, a lottery of lucky accidents could have produced this genetic complexity. Now, Grasset did not give another alternative explanation. He was described as, you know, the internal, mysterious internal factors. Murray Eden of MIT brought together leading mathematicians to confront Darwinists in the mid-1960s. Murray Eden at the Wistar Institute at the Ivy League campus, University of Pennsylvania, aired these differences. I think Murray Eden and Marcel Schützenberger of Paris, a double doctorate member of the French Academy of Science, I think their critique of natural selection is devastating. Fast forward to Michael Denton. Let me just give one more example. An agnostic, not a Christian, not a creationist, an agnostic, in his book Evolution, A Theory in Crisis, he says the notion that random mutations, lucky genetic typographical errors, could create whole new reams of genetic text is so mythological. He said the Darwinian theory of evolution is no more nor less than the great cosmogenic myth of the 20th century. And I could add other examples, the recently published book from MIT Press, Origination of Organismal Form. I believe that the theory of macroevolution through random typographical errors is in a state of meltdown and implosion. And I think everybody knows it out there.
Is that true, Chris? Is the thing that you've spent your life studying in meltdown?
Well, yeah, no biologist would say that natural selection is the only mechanism of evolution. And since Grasset published and Denton published, there's been so much more information. In fact, Denton's admitted that a lot of what he wrote in his book in the 1986 has been basically disproven by modern
molecular biology. I would love to hear what that is.
Well, he said that what molecular biology has shown is all genomes are clustered in a very small range of space and are reachable by a small series of steps. That's what he said in his latest book.
Well, you mean Nature's Destiny?
Yes.
Okay. Well, we'll discuss that later, because there's powerful evidence from Doug Axe to the contrary.
But essentially what you're saying, Chris, is that obviously intelligent design picks up many problems with basing everything on natural selection, but you're saying there are other ways of getting to the complexity we see than just natural selection.
Firstly, I think the idea you get from natural selection is that a change will occur, and if that change is beneficial, then it will persist in the population and be selected for. But so that suggests that you have to wait for a change that provides some benefit to come along. And so the idea that those kind of small changes, I mean, you hear about moths changing colour, that kind of thing, you think, well, surely that can't have produced the entire complexity of life. But that isn't the idea. I mean, we've seen in the past decade a field called evolutionary developmental biology, which shows us how even small mutations can cause substantial changes in the form of organisms. And we can look at the development of different organisms to understand how evolution has shaped organismal form. And there's nothing we've found in the biological world that's caused scientists to say evolution couldn't have possibly produced that. There's, very, very few scientist is saying that.
Well, thank you very much for joining us on the line, Chris. Been good to get your comments. Thank you for those. Pete, I mean, going back to this point about the fact that Chris was saying, the fact is, even if intelligent design theorists have pointed out some problems, they haven't given us any solution to those problems. I mean, is that your main concern here?
Absolutely, yeah. I'd agree with what you were saying. I'd also agree with what Chris was saying. But first I have to say that Dr. Woodward is a superb rhetorician. I couldn't help laugh at his use of language. We're in a case of meltdown. That's superb.
maybe over the top. My apologies if I offended you.
Not at all. on the question of randomness can't create information, I don't think that's quite what Dr. Woodward said, but it was something to that effect. You're quite right. A totally random situation cannot create something that's useful. But of course, we've got randomness plus a selection mechanism. I emphasise selection, and that's what allows random mutations, good ones to be retained, bad ones to be thrown away, and always working towards something that it creates a great design. Now, this isn't theoretical entirely. I mean, we use things called evolutionary algorithms in computer science and in engineering to create sometimes quite spectacularly unexpected designs. Now, Dr. Woodward might kind of, but there was the intelligence put in there to create them. I see him nodding his head exactly as I say that. Of course, the intelligence was in creating the algorithm and creating the selection mechanism, not the design. The design was not a goal. It was not purposeful goal in the sense that we expected the bridge to come out looking that shape. The algorithm determined that. And in a sense, if we start to wander into theology later on, you could regard God as the creator of the algorithm. Right. But evolution is the algorithm in progress.
Okay. Well, interesting aspects here. We're going to have to just draw this first section to a close. And in the second section, we're going to maybe be spending a little more time on questions about intelligent design. Is it simply a god of the gaps, as some people have claimed? And as those gaps grow smaller, will the intelligent designer's ground grow smaller? I don't know. We'll look into that. And whether evolutionists are guilty of doggedly holding to beliefs. They've been accused of misrepresentation from certain quarters in the intelligent design field. We'll be looking at some of those things. Do keep tuned and get in touch as well if you hear anything you'd like to agree with, disagree with or comment on in the programme today. The email address, unbelievable@premier.org.uk, and you can get in touch by phone 08456 52 52 52, select option 5. Leave me a voicemail message. I'd be delighted to play it out on the programme next week and indeed to pass it on to our guests if it's relevant. Do join us again in just a couple of minutes' time. Welcome back, and we'll be returning to our discussion on Darwin versus design in just a moment. Let me say, though, that if you're listening and you'd like to know what's at this time next week, I'm delighted to welcome into the studio next week atheist lawyer Edward Turner. Now, he got in touch with us saying that he's an atheist and he'd like to do a discussion with a Christian about whether there really is any evidence for the Bible being reliable or Christianity being a good thing. And I said, be my guest, come on the programme. So he's going to be joining us. In fact, for 2 weeks I've invited him to come on with his lawyer's hat on, as it were, and put Christianity on trial. He's going to be putting the Bible and Christianity on trial for the next 2 weeks. Standing in defence is apologist Andy Bannister from the London School of Theology. I think it's going to be a fascinating couple of weeks, so do tune in next week between 2:30 and 4 o'clock. Get us on the podcast as well at premier.org.uk/unbelievable. And while you're there, do check out the Premier community. Log on, have your say on some of the issues that are going on the Unbelievable page of the Premier community site. Okay, let's go back to the matter in hand.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
And the same email address and number apply if you'd like to respond to anything you hear in this programme today. We're talking about intelligent design and evolution. Title of our show today, Darwin versus Design. And in the first half, we've been hearing about the differences of opinion between our guests here in the studio. On the one side, Dr. Tom Woodward, founder and director of the C.S. Lewis Society. He's been involved in the emerging
intelligent design debate for some time. And his book is Doubts About Darwin. That gives an overview of the movement. His latest book is the sequel to that, Darwin Strikes Back. He's here in favour of intelligent design. Pete Harty is a member of the National Secular Society. He is an evolutionist, and he believes intelligent design simply doesn't offer the answers it claims to. And evolution, well, we have to just give it time. You know, we're at the very beginnings, as he said earlier, of a modern understanding of biochemistry. And we have to allow these things to have a bit more time to uncover some of the answers to the questions we have. Well, we're going to be looking at whether intelligent design is a viable alternative to evolution. We're going to be asking whether it's just a god of the gaps, as some people claim, and whether evolutionists themselves are guilty of sticking by evolution more like a dogma than a theory. That's all to come in the rest of today's Unbelievable. Let's go to this question then of the god of the gaps. I seem to remember you put this in last time you were with us, Pete. What do we mean by intelligent design being a god of the gaps?
The idea behind the god of the gaps is that you use God to explain everything that you don't understand. And therefore, as your understanding increases, it's a bad idea from a theologian's point of view, because it means God gets smaller and smaller and gradually gets squeezed out. So you don't want to posit your idea of God based on what you don't know. Now, to some extent, that's certainly how I see intelligent design. It seems to be saying that there's things we don't understand, therefore God did it. That's essentially the crux of it. I mean, there's more to it than that, obviously. But I see that as being the base idea behind intelligent design. But I've been thinking about it a little bit since last time, and I think it's worse than that.
Okay.
Because if you think about the picture of God that's depicted by the intelligent design movement, here you have a God who sets the laws of the universe, sets all the constants so that we can have stars, we can have nuclear fusion, we can have planets, and then we can have one very special planet where we can have life. And then it stops working. The laws of the universe don't quite work the way God wants them to, so he has to go in and manually create proteins and manually create cells. And then bacteria don't have any little tails to get around with, so he has to stop the laws of the universe and stick tails on the bacteria to get them to swim about. And it doesn't sound like the God I was taught about in school. The God I was taught about was omnipotent, all-knowing, far-seeing and perfect, whereas this God keeps making mistakes. He keeps having to go in and manually patch the universe because he wasn't clever enough to figure out laws in the first place that he could put in place and stick to, and therefore keep himself hidden from us.
Tom.
Okay, the idea of evolution is that a God really doesn't have anything to do. After he sets the laws, he sits back, stretches his arms, takes a snooze in the bleachers, and watch the whole play out on its own, which is a very clever and very engaging image. I mean, if I were maybe one of the philosophers, Spinoza or Schleiermacher, the founder of religious liberalism, I would glory in that. But the problem with that is that it's just against the evidence. Again, we come down to the ultimate question is not what theological picture works, but what does the evidence of science say? And there's no evidence that any clump of information has ever come into existence in the history of the universe. Any dense clump, let's say with 25 gigabytes, or let's go lower it down to 10 kilobytes, 10,000 bits of information. I think Pete Harty or any scientist in this country or any science in the world would be hard put to say, I know of one place where I have demonstrated under the observation of a camera or any kind of recording system where this information has arisen from just the blind interaction of laws. I would paint a new picture. To me, the laws of the universe are like the beautiful Stradivarius violin that the finest crafter of instruments in the world has crafted. But we know that a Stradivarius violin will not, just sitting there on the table, produce the notes of Mozart. No, I would say that God did create, in fine-tuning, the Stradivarius violin, but then he also has the ability, since he is the ultimate composer, of creating a Mozart and a Bach sonata, violin sonata, or to use a different image, God is the creator of the wonderful canvas hanging on the side of the wall of the Louvre. But he also is the God who has the ability to come up and apply the little blips of color to create this beautiful picture. That's the information put on the wonderful bass, if you will. And the Stradivarius is like the bass, and the information, or the painting or the music, that's the information, that's the DNA, that's the molecular complexity. And God, if he's God, can obviously work at both levels and is glorified at both levels, if we want to be theological about it.
Okay.
Can I just quickly come back on ahead. That, Justin? I didn't actually say that God sort of lit the blue touch paper and then sat back and did nothing. What I said was that he acted in a way that was consistent with natural law. Mm-hmm. Now, a lot of natural law is based on randomness, certainly the theory of evolution, but also if you look into other scientific theories, our theory of the atom is based on randomness. Our theories of thermodynamics and heat exchange are all based on randomness. Randomness is pervasive and is responsible for a great deal of emergent structure at all sorts of levels in science. Mm-hmm. But of course that's random to us, not to an all-seeing God. Mm-hmm. There's perfectly possible opportunities that you could see for a God to both act consistently with the laws of nature, and yet we don't see it.
Yes, well, I think the evidence against is the key. I would say that the evidence of biochemistry, of just geology, if you want to go in that direction, I'd rather keep it to biochemistry and biology, shows that randomness has never been shown, empirically shown, to produce any more than a couple minor variations on existing information. And generally, from what we've learned, it tends to degrade information. Randomness has never produced a single clump of information in the history of the universe. And if there's one thing we've learned about in this biological revolution since the molecular biology came in, is that humans and all animals and plants are massive congregations of intense information, 20,000 files on our hard drive.
What about this God of the Gaps situation? Pete, I guess your hope is that as the science moves on, that it will find explanations, for instance, for the bacterial flagellum and things like that, that there will be a pathway that fits with evolutionary theory discovered. I mean, if that happened, Tom, would you have to say, OK, we got it wrong?
Well, I would say if science can demonstrate and any time in the near future, any time, that natural laws are out there that can produce information, then I, as a Christian, one who accepts God as the ultimate creator of the universe, would say, well, wow, so that's how God did it. Mm-hmm. And then I may have to consider, you know, do I need to tweak my understanding of Genesis at that point? At the present, I see, and again, this is where I would say God of the Gaps is the opposite of the information that we're getting now. I mean, the situation we're in now. It's not these gaps, these little, you know, little holes in information. It's just the opposite. It's new information. It's the growth of information, which is driving ID.
I mean, just very quickly, Justin, I don't know where this idea comes from that you cannot create information. I don't know of any such principle in science that says information cannot be created. Genes can be duplicated. Selection pressure can then act to make those genes do other things, take on other functions. There's nothing complex, there's nothing mysterious about this.
Do you have any empirical evidence of a single gene that has been created by natural processes?
As I say, I'm not a biologist. Mm-hmm. I would have to consult a biologist on that, but I've heard them talk of polyploidy in plants where whole genomes get duplicated and then reused.
If I could just explain, polyploidy is a process where a new plant species does pop into existence when the entire genome is either doubled or multiplied and by some factor of 2, 3, 4. Polyploidy is like taking my hard drive and then developing a backup. And that's just making another copy of information. It's not producing new information.
But the information can then change.
By natural selection theory, yes. But have we ever seen a new structure or a single gene come into existence by natural selection? I know of no empirical evidence, and I've been asking biologists for 10 years now.
Okay. We're going to introduce another phone guest at this point.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
We're talking intelligent design and evolution this afternoon. Interesting stuff. I mean, this goes so deep, we can only really scratch the surface, and I'm afraid we'll never get the fullness of a debate. You'd have to go to a conference on this, I think, to really unpack all the minutiae. But joining us on the phone now is Peter S. Williams of the Damaris Trust. Peter writes and speaks on intelligent design and philosophy. And but part of his job, I suppose, with Damaris Trust is trying to see this brought into the public arena more and more. Good afternoon to you, Peter.
Good afternoon there. Hi.
Good to have you with us. So you've been hearing what our guests here in the studio have been saying. Any thoughts strike you, things that you would have liked to bring to the debate?
Sure. Two points, really, I think. One on this question of whether intelligent design is just a sort of God of the gaps argument, to look at some structure and then to reach the conclusion from looking at that structure that it must have been designed by some intelligence, is somehow to kind of make a kind of leap of faith to a conclusion of design and to subvert the whole kind of scientific process. I just simply point out on this that, you know, if an archaeologist digs up a Rosetta Stone and looks at that stone and looks at the writing on the stone and says, ah, you know, someone carved this stone. There was a designer of this pattern on the stone. You know, no fellow archaeologist turns to him and says, oh, that's just a stone carver of the gaps. You've got to keep looking for a scientific law or some kind of chance explanation or some kind of combination of law and chance that will explain that stone. Otherwise, you've given up on science and now you're in theology or something.
But isn't the point that, I suppose, for the scientist, they can't go there? I mean, that's what you're saying, isn't it, essentially?
Yeah, it comes back down to this question perhaps you're going to be moving on to, of is Darwinism based on a dogma? And I think, you know, to say to the archaeologist who discovers the Rosetta Stone or a statue or whatever, you can't explain it by intelligence, that's just a leap of faith. Well, no, they're reasoning from their knowledge of the cause and effect structure of the world, from the evidence before them, to a very reasonable conclusion.
So, Pete Harty, on this occasion, why is it that, as a scientist, it's you can't go to the explanation of intelligence? Why is that ruled out as far as you're concerned? Because it's used in so many other areas.
It's not ruled out. It's perfectly possible that the bacterial flagellum was designed by a creator god. It's just that we can't test that hypothesis. It's perfectly possible that he did it through the laws of evolution, and that was how he created the bacterial flagellum and the cell wall and all the other things that we find so incredibly mysterious. We're just saying that it's not part of the scientific body of knowledge because there's no way we can disprove it, there's no way we can test it.
The problem for me is that then are you kind of, is it a priori assumptions that are dictating that? Is it the fact that because science has a materialistic view of the world, therefore anything that doesn't fit into that category is obviously beyond the bounds of science, therefore can't count as science?
I think that's exactly it. I mean, it's one of the things that has been objected to that the intelligent design movement have objected to, is that science only countenances naturalistic explanations. But of course, science is the study of nature. It's not a surprise that it restricts itself to natural explanations. The supernatural, by definition, is beyond its remit. It simply can't study the subject.
Yeah, well, let me just jump in. The whole idea of supernatural is implied in ID. That is maybe a theological or philosophical implication. But the notion of supernatural, which I know Pete Harty would love to bring in there and kind of keep it, you know, it's pegged in the middle so that we can see God is right there, you know. Well, but that's not what ID is saying. We believe that when you step into the supernatural, you are, by definition, dealing with something beyond nature. Now, you can infer to a transcendent intelligence beyond the universe. We think that's a perfectly legitimate inference or implication. But you can only, let me just say, conclude intelligent causation from the data themselves. And let me just say that I think that Darwinism fails itself as a theory that can be tested, because when we've brought out critiques of the Darwinian notion of the flagellum being evolved, they will say, well, how do you know that there's no other pathway? How do you know that we could go on for millions of years looking for pathways? And so the issue is not, can we go on forever looking for some other naturalistic pathway? We take the inference to the best explanation. ID is built on a notion which is accepted throughout science. It's called inference to the best explanation. And if you have multiple competing hypotheses, you take the one that seems to me to seems to be the most logical inference based on the available evidence, not on some future hope of some other pathway.
Peter Williams, if I could just bring you in at this point. I mean, is there ever a chance that the scientific community is going to take intelligent design seriously because of its relationship with something which is beyond the natural? And that's just something that science just hasn't had to deal with up till now, has it?
Well, I think more and more members of the scientific community, as a kind of empirical fact, are taking intelligent design more seriously. Mm-hmm. If we go back to my illustration of kind of digging up a statue and it, concluding that it was designed, you know, the other archaeologists don't say to our statue digging up archaeologist, now you can't mention intelligence because that's not a natural explanation. Science is all about giving natural explanations in the natural world. They don't say that. Even if, you know, we don't know who made that statue, it's a theoretical possibility that a supernatural agent created that statue. Philosophically speaking, you know, that's a philosophical discussion whether you rule that in or out. But the question of was the statue caused by an intelligence is fully within the remit of science already. All intelligent design.
Peter, we had this discussion last time.
And applying that kind of reasoning in other fields within cosmology and biology and so on.
Go ahead,
Peter, we had this discussion last time. Archaeology is the study of human artefacts. It's no surprise that archaeologists come to the conclusion that they think artefacts are made by humans. It's exactly what they're paid to do. The idea that that's not a natural explanation, I mean, human beings, in my worldview at least, are extremely intelligent animals. It's a perfectly natural explanation that they should master tools and master writing.
Well, that's exactly my point. The conclusion that something is intelligently designed does not imply the conclusion that the designer was not natural.
Yes, but that's an a priori assumption in archaeology that you're dealing with an intelligence. You don't want to demonstrate that you've got evidence that proves the existence of an a priori intelligence.
The a priori assumption is not that whatever you dig up has been created by intelligence. It's that whatever you dig up could have been made by an intelligence.
Yes, but
to whether or not you think that is the explanation by looking at the evidence.
No, that's not the case at all. I mean, an archaeologist is dealing with a certain type of society that they're investigating. They know the capabilities of that society. They know the artifacts they find are going to be based on that society.
Can I just jump in and just say that naturalism is the key issue, I think. Naturalism is the theory is that nature is all that there is, or minimalistically, nature is all that we can ever detect. We can never go beyond chance and necessity, or natural law and chance. If you open up to, let's say, other possibilities of intelligent causation, and even not only within the universe but beyond the universe, and just say, we're not going to forbid any conceivable intelligence, we're not going to put anything off the table, everything's on the table, then you open up science to a new unfettered and unrestricted and unconstrained day in which every scientist is free to propose testable ideas about origins.
Is that your worst nightmare, Pete?
No, not... Well, in some sense, yes, but... I think there's a lot of truth in what Dr. Woodward is saying, right? There is an assumption built into science, which a lot of scientists have not acknowledged, that it is inherently a naturalistic, or it's looking for naturalistic explanations of the world that we live in. Now, I happen to think that is a good methodology. It's been extremely successful. You can't say for certain that there's no other agency that we can't understand. But I've got two problems with introducing non-naturalistic explanations into the study of nature. The first is that if you really can have arbitrary suspensions of natural law, then that means you can never trust an experiment ever again. You can never be sure you're going to get the same experimental results or that it demonstrates anything about underlying laws of nature if they exist. The second thing is that it brings intellectual curiosity to a stop. Now, I want to bring up an example from Dr. Woodward's book. There was an excellent example in here of avian lungs. Now, I didn't know this. Again, it's my lack of training in biology. But apparently, birds have a very different type of breathing from every other known living animal. They have a sort of pass-through lung system as opposed to the bellows type of you and I where we breathe in and out. Now, My instant reaction to that was, wow, that's amazing. Uh-huh. How did it happen? Why did it happen? What advantages does it convey? I wonder if anyone's looking at this. What have they found out? It was an explosion of 100 questions. If your answer to that is, it's too complicated to have come about by natural means, there must have been some intervention from some other agency, your curiosity stops. You've got nowhere to go.
Okay.
Is this the death of science? Well, intelligent design?
No, the number one, I think that the first idea is that we can't trust scientific laws anymore. We can't trust experiments anymore is a caricature. And I'd like to go back to the notion of the violin. The laws of nature are the violin. The information is as it were, the musical notes played on it. If we believe that musical notes can be added in upon top the laws of nature, that doesn't destroy the violin. It just brings out the beauty and the inherent capacities of the violin.
You seem to be convinced, Tom, that this is the new paradigm, the new scientific paradigm.
In my new book, I'm predicting by the year 2025 at the latest, Darwinism will have faded from the scene entirely.
The other issue I wanted to address was the one of dogmatism. Now, I think here, this is one thing the intelligent design movement has raised, which I think is important. There has been a degree of dogmatism in science, and to some extent it's got mixed up with the fact that some atheists have used the theory of evolution as a sort of stick to beat Christians with. I think we have to disentangle these two subjects. We cannot have this perception out there amongst Christians that if you believe in the theory of evolution, you're an atheist, or that you have a natural, that only if you accept a naturalistic explanation for things in the world, that makes you an atheist. If I could give an example to the people out there, I just happen to have a bunch of documents here, one of which is the handbook for my DVD player. Now, I've searched through that, and it doesn't mention God once, mm-hmm. right? It says, if you press buttons, this will happen, right? It's a purely naturalistic explanation of how that device works. The reason it doesn't mention God is because it doesn't matter whether you believe in God or not in order to work that DVD player. It will still work just the same. Exactly the same is true of the theory of evolution. It is a naturalistic explanation of the natural world. Best attempt to explain that natural world. As soon as you go outside naturalistic explanations, you're into theology, you're into God, you're into other things. It's not science anymore.
Well, this takes us into areas we've already mm-hmm. discussed, and we've going to have to agree to differ on, yes. on what constitutes.
Well, let me just say that if I could recommend one book that really presents, I think, the ID concept before ID existed, it was C.S. Lewis's book, Miracles. And he pointed out that you do not have to have the laws of nature broken, suspended, damaged, or in any way impugned. God, if he exists, and of course Lewis and I would believe that God does exist, he could feed new events into this ongoing flow, this cataract, this waterfall of events. And as soon as the new information or new event is fed in, it's folded in, just as my wife might throw blueberries into the batter that she's beating in her mixer. And so that new event enters, and it does not break the laws.
All right, we are going to have to draw things to a halt here, because we could go on all afternoon, but we're over time already. Gentlemen, thank you very much for both being here and really thrashing this one out. I look forward to. I want you both back in 20 years and see.
I may have to bite my eat my pie, my humble
blood
pie.
Pressure permitting.
I pray for that.
Okay, so just agree to come back in 20 years.
Okay, that's a deal.
Does that mean we don't get to come back before then?
Well,
how about a half time? 10 years.
Either way, it's been a fascinating discussion, and let me just say that Tom Woodward's new book, Darwin Strikes Back, is available now. It's published via Baker Books. You can get it on Amazon, I'm sure, mm-hmm, Amazon.com. Mm-hmm. Thanks to you, Pete. You haven't got any books out at the moment or anything, have
Unfortunately,
you?
Unfortunately, no.
No.
If people wanted to get a good example of Christians who are working with things like the theory of evolution, I'd recommend the Christians in Science website at www.cis.org.uk.
All right. Thank you very much, gentlemen, for both being with us. We've been talking about Darwin versus design. And if you want to get in touch, as usual, to anything that you've heard in the programme, do email me. It's unbelievable@premier.org.uk. And if you want to get in touch by phone, then that's just as easy. 08456 52 52 52 and select option 5. You're unbelievable. And do check us out on our website as well, www.premier.org.uk/unbelievable. Listen to this programme there, pass it on to a friend. That's the way that the word gets out. Lots of past programmes to listen to as well. And of course, check out the new Premier community. It's available through the webpage. Okay, next week I'm going to be talking to Edward Turner and Andy Bannister. Edward, atheist lawyer, is going to be putting Christianity and the Bible on trial for the next 2 weeks. See what he thinks about it. See what defence Andy Bannister can offer up. That's at the same time next week, between 2:30 and 4 o'clock and online. Thanks for joining me. Dave and B are here next.
Stop by Sherwin-Williams and get 30% off select paints and stains June 13th through the 23rd. It's the perfect time to transform your space with color. Refresh your home inside and out with colors that make every space feel brand new. From cozy interiors to stunning exteriors, we've got the perfect shade for your next project. Shop the sale online or visit your neighborhood Sherwin-Williams store. Click the banner to learn more. Retail sales only. Some exclusions apply. See store for details.